Hello there, listeners. This is Anaele crawling right up into your ear to talk to you about the Dream Foundry. If you like your speculative content in a variety of formats, you're gonna love us. We're a home for everybody working in the speculative arts, whether they're writers, podcasters, translators, editors, artists, working in comics or games or good old-fashioned print. Our Media Exploration Club is up and running and currently exploring the theme of found families in a variety of works and mediums. I'm talking to you about this now because we're running our first Kickstarter. We're practicing an ancient form of alchemy where we'll transform your dollars into more and better content, more programs, and if you're very generous, a contest for beginners run by William Ledbetter and Sarah Felix. Backer rewards include the opportunity to have Charlie Jane Anders leave you a voicemail, Tina Connolly read you an affirmation, Space Dragon t-shirts, and more. Check us out, dreamfoundry.org, or track us down at Kickstarter to get in on the alchemy. Go forth, my pretties, and feed the Space Dragon.
Podcastle, episode 569, for April the 9th, 2019. The Yew's Embrace by Francesca Forrest, rated R. Welcome to Podcastle. I'm Associate Editor Matt Dovey, your host for today, released briefly from the dark slush mines beneath the castle, to present to you the first of an occasional new special.
Tales from the Vaults!
This fine flying castle has been broadcasting for nigh on 11 years at this point, putting out well over 500 episodes that probably accumulate to something like 15 days straight of fantastic short fantasy fiction. As proud as we are of all that fiction, we really wouldn't advise listening for 15 days straight. Maybe get some sleep instead. Perhaps a hot meal and a shower. Drink some water as well, friends. Good hydration is important. But that still leaves the problem of all those brilliant stories you might not know about. So, from time to time, once every few months maybe, we humble staff hobgoblins are going to take turns in pulling up a story from way back in the archive, one that we think deserves a new audience. Glorious co-editor Jen asked me if I was interested in hosting one of these episodes, and did I know what story I'd pick? And there was only one answer I could give, one that sprang to mind immediately. The Yew's Embrace by Francesca Forrest, narrated by Stephanie Marlia Morris, back in the grey mists of 2012. 2012! That feels about 15 years ago at this point. We were all so innocent and young back then. Well, we were all so young back then. Well, some of us, anyway. The Yew's Embrace first ran as episode 227, having been published in Strange Horizons in 2011. Your author, Francesca Forrest, is the author of The Inconvenient God from Annalunda Books, 2018, about a slacker god with a mysterious past, and of the novel Pen Pal from 2013, a story of friendship and heroism from the margins, as well as short stories that have appeared in Not One of Us, Strange Horizons, and other online and print venues, including anthologies. She's old enough to have four grown children, and young enough not to have mastered object permanence just yet. She lives in Western Massachusetts. Your reader today is the prolific Stephanie Marlia Morris. Stephanie is a recipient of the Octavia E. Butler Memorial Scholarship Award, and a graduate of the 2017 Clarion West Writers' Workshop. Her short fiction has appeared in Fire, Apex Magazine, Nightmare, and Pseudopod. She's a regular podcast reader for Uncanny Magazine, and has narrated short fiction for all of the Escape Artist podcasts, as well as Starship Sofa and Farfetch'd Fables. You can find her online at stephaniemarliamorris.com, or on Twitter at smarliamorris. Enough from me. You need to hear this story. We recommend listening in the shade of a tree, the sound of a stream nearby. And pay attention, because this one will go past quicker than you realise.
The Yew's Embrace by Francesca Forrest. We could still see the old king's blood in the cracks in the flagstones beneath the new king's feet when he announced to us all that this was a unification, not a conquest, and that we had nothing to fear from the soldiers that fenced us round. The new king said that my sister the queen would become his wife and that he'd make the old king's baby son his very own heir. That's how much he loved and honored our people, he said. A month later, on a stormy day when the rain blew in at the windows and puddled on the floor, and we were huddled round the hearth, spinning by the light of oil lamps, the king burst in, soaking wet. Eyes aglitter, he told my sister that he had caught Lele, the wet nurse, down by the stream at the edge of the Grove of the Gods, drowning the baby prince.
She said she wouldn't permit him to grow up under my authority, he said. I tried to save him, but I was too late.
He held up his dripping hands. Riverweed clung to his arms above the elbows.
She'll be punished, though,
the king continued, and you could see his whole body trembling like a struck bell as he spoke. It was anger, red anger, that caused him to shake. None of us dared to move.
I've ordered her flayed alive in the Grove of the Gods. It will stand as a lesson, he said,
catching us each by eye, one by one, lingering on my sister.
No one may cross me. I will show no mercy to those who oppose me.
I bit down hard on my lip, and I saw tears in the eyes of several of the other women. We all loved Lele, and Lele had loved little Framos more than gold or cream or kisses. My sister was as still as a figure painted on a wall. She didn't weep or speak. Even when the king put a hand on her shoulder, making a dark, wet spot bloom there as he spoke of children to come, she didn't stir. That night, we learned the soldiers charged with Lele's execution had deserted the king's service and fled. They were caught and killed, of course, but their deaths didn't stop their tale from spreading. How, under their knives, Lele had cried out to the gods, accusing the king and calling for justice, and how, as their rain of blows continued, she was transformed into a yew tree. I'm sure the king wished he could chop down the tree and burn it, but who would dare to assault the god's sanctuary with the god's power still resonant within? In a year's time, my sister bore Neros, and the king had a woman from his own country brought in to nurse the boy. We all wished to hate him, but he was a laughing, sunny baby. My sister would bounce him on her knee and sing to him when the nurse brought him to her, so we let go of our hate, though I'm sure I'm not the only one who felt a pang when walking by the stream at the edge of the Grove of the Gods. Neros was barely able to walk when the king took him in hand, determined to train him as a proper warrior heir from a young age. Year in and year out, we tried not to listen as he hectored, scolded, and swatted the poor child. Neros would slip away from his father when he could. One day in his eighth year, when I was laying out the new linen cloth to bleach in the sun and Neros was helping, we heard his father shouting for him. "You'd better run along," I said. "Come back when you get a chance, and I'll give you some bread with honey." Neros hugged me around the waist, burying his face in my chest.
"If Father hits me, I'll just run to Auntie in the trees," he said, voice muffled.
"Oh, yes? And who is Auntie in the trees?" I asked.
"She's my protector. She's down in the Grove of the Gods," he said.
I felt the hairs on my arms rise up. "You go down there? Someone speaks to you down there?"
"Auntie in the trees. The day I forgot to latch the gate and Father's new mare got out, I ran away to the trees down there and climbed up into one to hide. The branches held me close, and I heard a voice say, 'I'll keep you safe.' I asked who it was, and she said she was my auntie in the trees."
"You must show me the tree," I managed to say, though my mouth had gone dry and my pounding heart stole away my breath. But the king bellowed for Neros again, and the boy ran off.
Auntie in the trees has dark green needles and red berries,
he called back over his shoulder.
Her branches are red and raw, like arms without skin.
After the cloth was spread, I walked down to the end of the garden, crossed the stream at the bridge, and entered the Grove of the Gods, a circle of silent oaks standing sentinel over clover, poppies, and bindweed. I hadn't been to the grove since my sister married the old king, but I remembered it well enough to recognize the newcomer yew, more a thicket than a single tree, several narrow trunks outspread like hands shielding a face, with one great bough flung up and twisted, as if to ward off blows. I've seen spear hafts made of yew. They're a rich red color. Seeing that same ruddiness on the limbs of the living tree, so much like bare muscle and sinew, I thought of Lele and had to close my eyes. You don't mean to harm the new prince, do you? I asked, but the words felt like pebbles in my mouth. How can you question me? In my mind's eye, I saw Lele running after the new king, who carried a squirming bundle down to the stream. I saw her wrestle with him, saw the soldiers pull her away. I could almost feel the grip of their hands upon her and the cold rain streaming down her face and hair. Here, now, a cold wind pulled at my own hair and my skirts. I opened my eyes and saw thunderclouds. The oaks were murmuring now. The yew was whispering too, but not in human speech. Not in human speech, but I could feel the meaning all the same. How can you question me? It wasn't until some days later that I was able to give Neros the bread and honey I had promised him.
I have a brother, Neros announced, breaking off fragments of his bread and feeding them to the king's dogs,
who have a knack for finding people who are eating.
He's a year older than I am. He lives in the stream at the bottom of the garden.
The cook's knife stopped halfway through an onion, and she glanced at me, eyebrows raised. Her little maid, who was scaling the fish, looked at her mistress anxiously. A brother in the stream? I asked, keeping my tone light.
Yes. He can only eat fish and snails. He never gets bread. And he has to eat the fish raw because there isn't any fire under the water.
Neros bit down on his bread and chewed it slowly. One of the dogs licked Neros's free hand. How did you find this brother? I asked.
Did he call to you?
Breathed the maid, but the cook shushed her.
Auntie in the trees told me about him. She told me his name is Framos. She said if I stepped into the stream and called him, he'd come. And he did, and we talked.
Neros frowned.
Framos is lonely, though. He's all alone in the river. He asked me if I would come under the water with him, but...
Neros's frown deepened.
I was scared to, so I asked him if he could come out instead, and he said, maybe, if I grabbed his hands and pulled. So I did grab and pull, but I couldn't budge him. He stayed underneath. Father would say I'm a weakling, wouldn't he? Do you think Father would say I'm a weakling?
No, he wouldn't say that, I said. But I think he would say you shouldn't play in that stream, or by it, or...
I have to, insisted Neros. Otherwise, Framos will die of loneliness, and I'll lose my only brother. Auntie in the tree says I have a father and a mother and a palace full of people to love and serve me, but Framos has no one.
Neros squeezed his remaining fragment of bread between his fingers and thumb, squeezed it and rolled it. Then he threw it onto the floor and looked up at me.
Why does my brother live in a stream? He asked.
At just that moment, the king walked in. The cook's maid hid behind the cook.
What did you say?
The king asked, in a low, dangerous voice.
I want to know why my brother lives in a stream,
Neros repeated, balling his hands into fists as he stared at his father. The two of them wore matching frowns.
Auntie in the tree said you made him live there.
Who said it? She said it?
He pointed at me and crossed the room in quick strides. He had his knife in his hands. I think he meant to kill me then and there.
No, not her. Auntie in the trees. Auntie in the trees said it.
Neros's voice was thin, high, and desperate. He rammed into his father, knocking the knife from his hand and startling the dogs, who jumped up, barking. Then he ducked around him and dashed out of the kitchen.
The yew tree. He's running to the yew tree, and she'll have her revenge on you.
It must have been the god speaking through me. I would never have dared say those words to the king's face otherwise. I felt my heart twist as they came out, not for the king, but for Neros. The king went as pale as ashes and ran out after Neros, calling for his men to follow. I ran after, too, stopping only to tell one of my sister's women what was happening.
"Tell her to come," I said.
Who living had been more wronged than my sister? Maybe she could stop this fate from unfolding. Neros had slipped right into the heart of the yew and had climbed up as high as he could go. The yew clasped him tight in her bare, flayed arms. The king and his men were arrayed in a semicircle around the tree.
"Come down! Come down here right now!"
the king ordered, and under his breath,
"Let him go, or I will burn you down, and gods be damned."
"I won't," said Neros, still in that high, desperate voice. "Go pull my brother out of the stream. You put him there. Bring him back here where he belongs. Then I'll come down."
My sister and several of the other women arrived while Neros was speaking. Two bright patches shone on my sister's cheeks, but the rest of her face was as pale as the king's. Her chest heaved from running, but her mouth was tight shut, and her lips were bloodless.
"Pull him out, or I'll never come down. I'll die here,"
said Neros, his last words lost in a sob. The king stared wild-eyed at the tree and his son, cursed the yew first quietly and then loudly, then strode back to the stream and splashed in. Something made him cry out and leap from the water.
"Don't be surprised," said Neros. "He's not a baby anymore. He's big now, like me. But you're strong. You can pull him out."
The king growled like a dog and plunged back in. He bent down, and grimacing, he thrust his arms into the water, past his wrists, past his elbows, up practically to his shoulders. We could see the strain of his effort and the cords of his neck, but nothing happened. If anything, the king was being pulled down. I've heard the dead are supernaturally strong. Maybe, I thought, Framos means to drown him. And then, slowly, the king straightened up. His hands held the wrists of a boy, transparent as glass or water, who was draped and wreathed in riverweed. The boy's ghost eyes were fixed on the yew tree, and he smiled. Then he turned to his mother, standing just behind the king. He tilted his head, regarding her, and then he disappeared. The king was left holding the bones of an infant.
"That's very good, my lord. I see you have managed to save my son after all," said my sister, putting her left hand on the king's left shoulder. He flinched, but before he could make another move, she had driven a knife deep into his neck.
She lifted Framos's bones out of his hands, then took a step back and let the king collapse into the stream. She turned to address his men, fixing the lieutenant, whose hand had flown to his sword, with a hard stare.
"Think before you act. Sometimes the gods must use human tools to mete out justice. But there's a boy, blood of your master's blood, who will be king if you'll support him."
Then she approached the yew tree, knelt, and laid Framos's bones down gently in the clover.
"Here is the little one you suckled, the sweet baby we both loved," she said. "His murder has been avenged. Now you must send my other son back to me. Neros, come down now."
"I can't come down, mother,"
said Neros tremulously.
"Auntie in the trees is holding me too tightly. She won't let go."
It was true. The branches pressed against his face and arms and across his chest.
"Be thin and slippery like water,"
my sister urged. Slide right out of her arms. Nero's twisted and writhed, but only succeeded in scraping his arms and cheeks raw. His blood soaked into the yew's branches. A flaying for a flaying, I murmured, and again, I swear it was the gods that put the words in my mouth.
No!
My sister cried. Nero's continued to struggle, in tears now, as the branches held him ever more tightly.
You must save him, my sister said, speaking to the oaks. Please, Lele's claims are answered now.
The wind picked up, and the oaks whispered in conferral. Still Nero's wept, but we could not see him now, so close did the yew hold him. The oak swayed back and forth, the yew hunched her shoulders. And then something changed in the tone of Nero's sobs. Out from the branches' crushing embrace flew a little brown bird with red streaks on its cheeks and breast and wings. It circled the grove and disappeared into the clouds. Who can understand the gods? They spared Nero's life, but deprived us of his presence. Now we paint brown birds with red streaks on the men's shields, and we hope that my sister's supporters will outnumber the supporters of the king. We live in a time of miracles, I think to myself, as I scan the flocks of sparrows looking for Nero's. We live in a time of miracles, and yet still blood continues to be spilled, and it runs into the cracks in the flagstones.
And welcome back. I think it's worth a moment of silence to think that one over a while, isn't it? I remember Dave Thompson, in the original outro, commenting on how epic this story felt in its mere 2,500 words, if you can believe it. It's a whole history in half an hour, a timeless fairy tale in less time than it takes to eat that hot dinner I told you to get earlier. It's so astonishingly economical in everything it does. The setup is accomplished with such masterful precision, giving you a few strokes of detail, like the blood in the flagstones, that imply the full picture, giving you just enough context and grounding for what's coming. Nothing here is wasted, or out of place, or unnecessary, but it's all relentlessly sculpted towards one purpose. It's an archetypal short story in that regard. It has one thing it wants to do, and it doesn't waste time doing anything else. September 2012, when it was first broadcast, was just about the time I was starting to write properly, long before I was on staff here. It's one of the stories that really demonstrated to baby writer Matt what a fantasy short can be, can do, and it stuck with me ever since. As I said, it came to mind immediately when Jen asked me about re-hosting an old episode. It's a cliche to say it, but it's true. I have never looked at yew trees the same since. The idea of their bark as blood and sinew, as flayed flesh, is unsettlingly plausible. I'll leave you with that image, as the story left me with it. That was our show for this week. On behalf of everyone at Podcastle, our audio engineer, Peter Berevesh, and our former audio engineer who did Podcastle 227, Peter Wood, our forum moderator, Aussie Cat, your glorious co-editors, Jen Albert and Sheree Clark, along with all our fantastic first readers, Crystal Claxton, Aidan Doyle, Ebony Dunbar, Devon Martin, Ace Ratcliffe, Orion Rodriguez, Julian Jarbeau, Craig Jackson, Julia Pat, Hamilton Perez, Eleanor Wood, and myself, Matt Dovey, thank you for letting us share another story with you. Be sure to share it in turn with your friends, family, sworn enemies, passing strangers, nearby pigeons, everyone. Hit us up on Facebook and Twitter, where, show secret, unless you'll be talking to me. And if you would like to show the show some extra love, head to patreon.com/EAPodcasts. For special events, bonus episodes, and Podcastle appearances in the wild. And these days, some swag too, including exclusive mugs and stickers. Ooh! Podcastle is part of Escape Artists Incorporated and is distributed under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. That means, please share it, but don't sell it or change it. We'll be back next week, of course, with another tale. Until then, this is Matt Dovey, reminding you that secrets were always out, and justice will always have its day.